E.W. Bullinger. Now, there's a guy who looked into things. But really, it's quite logical when you figure that Genesis is the beginning and Revelation is the end. So how rocket science-y is it really when you're dealing with God here who is writing the scriptures? And why wouldn't the end wrap up the beginning? Good morning. This is Martin Zunder, serving humanity and serving God with a dissertation for over 3 years now on the book of Revelation. I mean, God is the ultimate author. No author worth his salt is going to write a dissatisfying book that leaves you flat and disappointed at the end. It's ridiculous. Any good writer, whether it's a novel or even an essay, is going to satisfy you at the end. It's going to reach a conclusion that ties up all the loose ends created by the author at the beginning of the book. Will God, the ultimate writer, do less? Of course not. So it's not real genius to think that, well, I wonder if Revelation answers problems that surfaced purposely in Genesis. God purposely made these problems in Genesis as plan A, so that he could show his power and his creativity and his love, his magnificence in the resolution of these things. Perfectly sensible, perfectly reasonable. As I look at my show log here, here's my show log. You can wonder why I can't read anything hardly. This is show number 777. There was a day when I thought that this would be a perfect place to end the show. Of course, there was a day when I, in my twisted mind, thought that maybe 666 would be the ultimate place to end a show on Revelation. But I thought, no. Even if it was close, I would have to do one more show, 667, just to break that thing, because that is a bad number. I'll tell you that, 666, it's a bad number. 777 is like the perfect number. But here I am, not finished yet. So now the temptation is to think about 800. 8 is a number of a new beginning. As you know, when I finish this series, I will begin on something new. Don't despair out there. Don't despair. I am with you to the consummation of the eon. Now, the apocalypse completes all that Genesis begins and introduces the new creation, lest we should think there is nothing beyond. Wouldn't that be tragic? There's nothing beyond the old creation. I'm again reading from a commentary on Revelation, E.W. Bullinger. This material may also be in one of the appendices of his companion Bible. If you don't have the companion Bible, it's a nice study tool. Not because the King James Version is the source text, but because of Bullinger's comments. King James Version is terrible, as you know, convicted of containing over 20,000 errors. Somebody called me on that recently. They said, how do you know it contains 20,000 errors? Well, I haven't counted them myself, but I read that somewhere, and it seems to me it was a reputable source. Yes, the same source that told me every thorn on a rose bush is a stunted rose. Same source. And it wouldn't be surprising to me if it was more, because if you just take a single word that's mistranslated, for instance, they take a word, a Greek word that ought to be translated depart. I did this in one of my early newsletters back in 1995, and they translated it 21 different ways. One word, 21 different ways. Well, there's 21 mistakes right there. That's just one Greek word. So yeah, 20,000 is letting them skate off lightly, I would say. The apocalypse completes. Yes, in Genesis, we have therefore the primal creation and the history of the curse which came upon the primal creation. Revelation tells how that curse will be removed and the new creation brought in. How simple. This is childlike language. This is language that is so rudimentary in its simplicity. And I ended here yesterday, I think, but I wanted to read it again. Revelation tells how that curse will be removed. Isn't that interesting? Isn't it interesting that something so primitively true, Christianity hasn't even gotten to the portal of that mansion yet, that everything will be removed. They think that everything came to stay. Death and sin and evil will never be removed. That's what Christianity says. That's a fun teaching. Where do I sign up for that nightmare? Any building on the corner of any street in America. That's where they usually are, street corners, churches. In Genesis, we have Satan's first revolt. And in Revelation, his final revolt. Isn't that nice? Final revolt. Final. Satan's works are arrested. And Satan himself, in the end, is conciliated to God. We know this. Colossians 1:16 through 20. Simple. The parallel between the two books may be thus set forth. And here we have parallel passages, Genesis and Revelation. Genesis, the earth created. Revelation, the earth pass away. Earth created, earth passes away. The sun, the moon, the stars are created for earth's government. Genesis 1, I could give the references to all of these. Bullinger has references here. The sun, the moon, the stars connected with earth's judgment. They turn on you. The sun turns on you. The moon turns on, not you, on the inhabitants of humanity. The sun is created to govern the day. Genesis 1:16. In Revelation, why do they have Roman numerals here? XXX.23, 10, 20, 30. No need of the sun. Revelation chapter 30? I don't think so. I'm confused. Anyway, we know that in the New Jerusalem, there's no need for the sun. The sun governs in Genesis. And that sounds great. What a blessing. That beautiful orb. That beautiful flaming ball of hydrogen that somehow is just miraculously suspended in the sky. There's going to be no need of it. Just when you think that's the best you can get. Oh no, it's even better. You don't even need the sun. You remember in the Holy of Holies, there was a glow. There was a light that was being emitted, which is rather strange because there was nothing but curtains, dark, deep, velvety curtains in the Holy of Holies where no natural light could possibly penetrate. And yet the priest that went in there once a year could see, and he did not take his cell phone in there. No, he did not take a candle. It was the glory of God shone. And that was just a little cubicle. What was it? 5 feet by 5 feet by 5 feet. 5 cubits by 5 cubits by 5 cubits. It was a tiny. The Holy of Holies was a tiny foretaste. An earnest. That the entire earth will be covered with the glory of God. But in an evil eon, you cannot expect what most people want to happen. They want the earth to be covered with the glory of God now, and they want to bring it in by their own hands, by their own creativity, their own intelligence, their own words, their own television shows and radio programs. But no, in an evil eon that's meant to show the contrasts between good and evil, and meant to show the weakness of humanity, the futility of humans saving themselves, God gives us a postage stamp sized indication of the glory. We're not without it, but it's very small. I told you that the orgasm is the same thing. Martin, I want to have an orgasm all the time. All right, well, good for you. I can't blame you. The theory is okay, but in practical application in our current bodies, it would destroy you. But God does give us a tiny indicator of how good it will feel when we are delivered from mortality. Because for a while, that little piece of pleasure delivers you from mortality. Then the window closes down quite quickly, and it's all over all too soon. However, our heavenly bliss will not go away, but we will need new bodies in order to contain the bliss. These bodies are destroyed not only by violent evil, but by unendurable pleasure. How strange some of the adjectives, the qualifiers put in front of the word pleasure. Unbearable pleasure, unendurable pleasure, right? It's strange. It is unbearable in our present bodies. But these bodies are going to pass away just like the earth will pass away. The sun and the moon, the sun to govern the day. Just when you think that was the best thing, there's no more need of the sun. There's the glory of God illuminates that new Jerusalem. Darkness is called night in Genesis 1:5. There is no night on the new Jerusalem. Okay, they took an X away here. Yes, 23:5. I think that's what they wanted to say up there instead of 30:23. Turn to Revelation chapter 30, please, verse 23. Now, there's no night on the New Jerusalem. Oh, man. And this is just on the New Jerusalem. This is just the farthest vision John has. Paul takes us beyond the New Jerusalem that descends out of heaven. Paul takes us into heaven, the third heaven in time, not the third heaven in space as we descend through the stratosphere, troposphere, mesosphere, exosphere. No. We see the third heaven in time. That is the third heaven corresponding to the third earth. When this present earth is destroyed, we have a new earth coming and also a new heavens. John takes us into the new earth. Paul got to go to the third heaven. Waters are called seas in in Genesis 1:10, in Revelation 21:1, there are no more seas. Just when you think, isn't that nice? The waters come, it's so beautiful to look out over the sea. The sea is right here in my backyard, practically, 2.5 miles away. But there's no more sea. I told you before, I'll say it again. The sea is representative of the masses of roiling humanity. Unease, unrestful, fitful. This will be changed. The earth will be a solid mass, and the peoples of the earth will reflect that solidity, that goodness, that finally resistance to change. A river for earth's blessing. Genesis 2:10 and 14. There's a river on the new earth that not only blesses people, they can go take a bath in it, they can drink from it. No, this river of life in the New Jerusalem feeds the trees that are for the healing of the nations, actually give you life. Humanity was created in God's image, Genesis 1:26. Here's the bad thing. Humanity is headed by one in Satan's image at the tail end of Eon 3 and Millennium 6, referenced there. Revelation chapter 13. The entrance of sin, chapter 3, Genesis. We all know about that. In Revelation, and really capped by Paul's gospel, we see the development and end of sin. Again, Christianity misses it here big time. Oh, they're all about the sin developing. The sin does develop during the eons subsequent to its entrance, eons 2 and 3. But what Christianity misses, and this is the whole point of everything, of Jesus Christ coming to the cross, we see sin developing. And Paul prophesies in 2 Timothy chapter 3 that in the last days perilous periods will be present in all their alliterative glory, and we are there. And so this is the development of sin. And yet, starting with Eon 4, we will see the gradual rescinding of sin. It will be starting to be abolished. Eon 4 is better than Eon 3. However, there's still death during the millennium. People live a long time like they did in the days before the flood, but they're still dying. We still have capital punishment. We still have the nations being ruled with a rod of iron. But in Eon 5, things will be improved. There will be no more death on that earth. All death will be relegated at that time to the second death. There will be no more tears, no more clamor, no more misery, no more dogs barking incessantly. Shut up! No more of that. You'll still see that a little bit in Eon 4. Roof, roof, roof. Quiet! No, that's still going to happen. Not as frequently as it does today. Dogs will be more obedient in Eon 4. In Eon 5, not going to be no dogs. This is the curs are outside. The curs are not in. So only good doggies, not bad doggies. Yes, and so sin is eventually eradicated, starting with Eon 4 and improving, a new and improved Eon 5. Then comes the consummation. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:26, the last enemy is being abolished at the consummation of the eons, which is death. If death is the last enemy, then friends, you know me, I make sense for a living. I'm a logical person. If death is the last enemy to be abolished, my conclusion is that every other enemy will have gone before it, if death is the last. Who's going to say after death is abolished? It'll be a great announcement. This is the last enemy. Come forward, and it's death. Those in the second death. We are hereby abolishing the last enemy. death. And everybody that was in the second death comes forward, vivified in Christ. 1 Corinthians 15:28 turns out to be true. What do you know? God becomes all in all. Jesus Christ is seen to be a successful Savior. What do you know? And then who is going to ask, okay, what's the next enemy to be abolished?
What's the next enemy to be abolished, Jesus?
No, I said that was the last one.
Yeah, but what's the next one? What about sin?
No, sin will have gone before. Death is the last enemy. Sin and death being rolled back. I love that. Curse is pronounced. Genesis 3:14-17. Woman, you will suffer greatly in childbearing. Man, you're going to have to hoe like crazy to make anything come up out of the ground. And here's a nice statement in Revelation 22:3. No more curse. Curse? No more curse. Sin? No more sin. Sea? No more sea. Darkness? No more darkness. Sun? No more sun. No more need for the sun because God illuminates it. The cherubim are first mentioned in connection with humanity in Genesis 3:24. I believe they guard the tree of life with flaming swords, kind of like those Star Wars things, laser lights, whatever you call those things. I'm not a big Star Wars fan here, folks. Whatever you call those things. Cherubim's final mention in connection with humanity is found in the book of Revelation. Humanity's driven out from Eden. That was a sad day. You were living in paradise, people. But it was necessary for sin and death to enter the world, and so they were driven out from Eden. Humanity is restored. I've said this many times. Humanity is going to be restored. Here's another one of those postage stamp deals where you see this tiny little tract of real estate along the Tigris and the Euphrates River in modern day Iraq, which was the literal Garden of Eden. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, atheists and worldly people and even some Christians. It's not a fairy tale. There was a Garden of Eden. Yes, there was a Garden of Eden. And it was a tiny picture of what the whole earth is going to be. But God had to establish. This is so great. Listen to this. It just occurred to me. God had to establish sin and death. He had to establish the rule of sin and death. And he does it with two people, of course, in the tiny little place. And he drives them away. Ouch. You know, that hurt. It was great. It was great. It was great. Now, we're out here on the back 40. We're out of the perfect paradise. And everybody born subsequent to them doesn't feel the same pang that Adam and Eve felt because they were actually in it and left it. That hurts. Okay, when you've experienced it. Nobody else since them ever experienced being in the Garden of Eden. So to them, it's like, yeah, we're born in a crappy little burg. We're born in Crapsville over here, or Dungsburg, or, you know, Miseryvania. It's just a nightmare. But, I mean, it's not a nightmare because it's just your life. It's your life as you know it. But when the restoration comes, it's not like it's just going to come to a couple people, you know, dolloped on them. The whole of creation is going to go through this veil into Eon 4 together, those who survive the tribulation. And it's going to cover the whole earth. So God is much more generous and he's much more all-encompassing in his blessing. Like I say, the curse effect too. The curse affected too. You might say, Martin, no, it affected everybody. Yes, but only two went from the beauty into Crapsville. But in the coming world, we're going to have a bunch of people transferred from Crapsville into a kingdom run by Jesus Christ, administered by his 12 apostles and the 144,000. And the glory of God is going to cover the entire earth. It's not like we're returning to paradise, back to the garden, as Crosby, Stills, and Nash sang. Let's get back to the garden. You don't want to get back to that garden. It's too small to fit everyone. But the regenerated earth, yeah, now we're talking. And the new earth, that's even better. Speaking about how Revelation answers Genesis, it's even better because it's huge. We don't know how huge it is because we don't have the dimensions of the new earth. It could be gigantic. It is gigantic. It's not going to be smaller. It's not going to be a scaled down version. Everything gets bigger and better. Genesis is, of course, the beginning. Genesis is God introducing the players. Genesis is God introducing the things that through his power, through his might, through his strength and his love, he is going to restore, not only restore, but take it to the next level. If he only restored it, then we'd all just be naked back on the banks of the Tigris and Euphrates River, hobnobbing with kangaroos and wombats, if it was only as good, if it's only a restoration. You would have to say, if he's only restoring creation, why are we going through all this crap in the first place? But no, you see, it is not a mere restoration. In Revelation, it is an eclipsing. It, just like Job. Job is the perfect template for this because Job was multiplied in children and goods and wealth. And I think his wife got nicer too, you know. And so Job was mega blessing in his latter days. The latter days were better than the former days. If the latter days aren't better than the former days, then what's the purpose of having gone through all this? Why did God even start it? So it's going to be so much better, and especially so in the fact that the ensuing eons from Genesis to Revelation have been filled with sin and evil, and this gives us knowledge. And with this knowledge, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you can't know good apart from evil. This knowledge of the contrast will fuel our appreciation for all eternity. And again, it's that investment thing. You buy a little bit of experience and it fuels you for the rest of eternity. You're never going to forget the hellhole you came from here, but it's not going to give you a pang. It's not even going to be bittersweet. It's going to be pure sweetness. It's like the bad side of that will be completely gone, but not the sense, not the feeling of contrast. You have been delivered from so great a burden as sin and death, delivered from that into the glorious liberty of the life of God.